Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Jeff Sullivan is on Twitter at @based_ball. The senior editor at Fangraphs joins the Bernstein and McKnight show as he does at this time each week. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
So my instinct usually when something is going badly for a certain area player is to look at peripheral numbers and say, you know what, he's probably fine. And I looked at Jose Quintana's numbers and I can't say that. What's going on with him?
I was actually just looking at Jose Quintana, sort of anticipating this. And, you know, Quintana's always leaned on his fastball. And I can tell you, there's something else that's particular, I would say, to this radio broadcast. The two worst teams in baseball right now in pitch framing. I don't know if I need to explain pitch framing, but they happen to be the White Sox and the Cubs. These are teams that have not been able to be so successful around the edges. And I think not so much of a surprise. You look at the White Sox, and they haven't had necessarily great pitch framers for a while. They're an up-and-coming ball club. With Cubs, you look at Wilson Contreras, who's got a lot of strengths, and he's got a few weaknesses. And he's not a smooth receiver, I would say. So I don't want to make too much of this necessarily, but you figure Jose Quintana is a guy who thrives on working around the edges. He's certainly not a blow-you-away kind of pitcher. And you look at a game like yesterday, and it's home run trouble that got him, and he's a guy who historically hasn't allowed that many home runs. When the wind gets it, then, you know, what's going to happen. But this year, he has been less successful. I think his out-of-zone chase rate, so hitters have swung at pitches out of the zone against him far less often than they did just last year. His stuff looks basically the same. He's missing bats about as much as he always has, but he just hasn't been so successful around the fringes. I don't think that's all on the Cubs catchers, but it's probably a factor here. It's probably about more than just Jose Quintana alone.
Well, I was going to say, Jeff, I mean, he's pitched before and pitched really well in the American League with a designated hitter and on a team that was expected to succeed at different points in his White Sox career and still had bad pitch framing. What is the adjustment he can make to overcome missing those corners or not getting those calls on those corners? Is it, I mean, if he has to find more of the zone, don't we run into more contact?
It looks like he's been trying to use he's got a couple fastballs and he's going between his two seamer and his four seamer. A lot of pitchers do this, and he's been throwing a good number more four-seamers this year. I wonder if part of that is just that maybe his four-seamer isn't as advanced as his two-seamer is. Maybe he's trying to throw it up in the zone more often. And, you know, on a windy day in Chicago, that's not going to work very well for him. So I think that this is one of those things where there's probably not as much wrong with him as the numbers would suggest. He's not a walk a batter every two innings kind of pitcher. His command is better than that, should be better than that. I think he's not really that far away, but he's the kind of pitcher where when he makes the adjustment that he needs to make, because he's gone through stretches of having this home run trouble before. It's his fastball that's been abused the most, but when he makes the adjustment to get back to being Jose Quintana, I think it's the kind of thing that you're going to watch a game and think, was that so different? I didn't really see it, because for him, it's really a matter of about an inch and a half.
When you look at pitching in that way, is there a way you can measure framing-reliant pitchers and say that this guy needs more help, or this guy has got a higher range of benefit from framing than others, depending on where they live in the strike zone and where their little personal heat map is?
Yeah, I think you can look for the pitchers who live around the edges of the zone the most. You know, coincidentally, someone like John Lester. I mean, John Lester and David Ross back in the day had maybe the most symbiotic relationship of any catcher-pitcher framing relationship of the past, I don't know, 10 years. When we had data for that, it was through the roof. Ross was saving Lester like 10 runs a year. Anyway, you look for a guy who's thriving around the edges, not really obviously a swing-and-miss pitcher isn't going to care about framing very much. If you're, I don't know, take Zach Godley. He's a pitcher for the Diamondbacks. His whole thing is that he throws unhittable curveballs that are about a foot below the plate. He doesn't care about pitch framing that much. That's not what he is. You have a guy like Yu Darvish throws stuff that's so hard and moves so much, he's almost impossible to frame very well to begin with. You just can't expect it. Someone like Shohei Ohtani is going to be really hard to frame. So you're looking for the sort of the fastball and cutter heavy pitchers who don't have really high velocity, who you know are just supposed to pitch around the edges and get a lot of called third strikes. Guys like Jose Quintana and guys like John Lester. Lester, of course, has been very successful with this before in Chicago, and Quintana is trying to make it with a different catcher.
Jeff Sullivan of FanGraphs joining the Bernstein and McKnight show here on a Tuesday morning, as he always does. Joe Maddon's going to join the show a little bit later on, Jeff, and he's already talked after yesterday's game about the short starts and how much that's getting into the Cubs bullpen and how many arms are being taxed at this point. What do we know about how long bullpens can last at the rate the Cubs have lasted, at the rate that burnout can run through guys like this? I know bullpenning is a fun new word, but we're not there yet with how this Cubs roster is constructed.
I know there was concern early, I think it was last year, that the Mets had about three good relievers, and they were throwing them out there, it seemed like, almost every other day. And one of the most difficult things when you are a fan is that when you're watching a game in April or May, and let's say your manager doesn't bring in the right or maybe the best reliever for a given inning, and then the backup reliever blows game or gives up the lead, as a fan, you're going to think that's inexcusable because you're never really thinking about preservation. But like you're getting at, the bullpen has to survive for six, realistically, if you're the Cubs, 7 months of the season. So you have to be really conservative with who you're using, and that does require longer starts. Now, when you have a guy like Tyler Chatwood, he's not really a long start kind of guy. You have a guy like Jose Quintana, who right now, when he's in walk-in home run trouble, he's not a long start guy. Yu Darvish, of course, has not yet been that long start guy. And I think coming into the year, when you looked at the Cubs, if there was one real concern, it's that they didn't have the deepest bullpen, because you look around and there are a lot of teams who are going to be going through 10 to 12 to even 15 relievers on a somewhat regular basis, sort of that taxi squad idea. I don't think the Cubs pitching has gone that deep. It's really good at the top, but you know, how much of this is going to come down to, will they ever get a reliable version of Justin Wilson? Is that going to happen? It seems like they are probably going to need to make some sort of bullpen addition, because it is going to be difficult. They're in a dogfight. There are four pretty good teams in this division, which means they can't really take too many days off. You can't expect that many innings from some of the starters in the rotation. So they're going to have to get deeper in the bullpen, because they are going to be taxed, and I think that's a really hard thing to avoid.
So, Jeff, on the South side, the rebuild continues, and we talked Friday with Matt Davidson of the White Sox, and he was featured in a piece you wrote about some of the most changed hitters in baseball from last year to this year. Davidson's got a 974 OPS, a 164 OPS plus. He is 27 years old and hitting for a boatload of power. Do the White Sox start to change the calculus on who they keep around? Is Matt Davidson a guy that you, based on the changes that you've seen, a cornerstone now of what they can do in the future?
I was just looking at Davidson, thinking that I think he's deserving of a follow up. So at 27 years old, he's been in the major. Obviously, he played most of a full season last year. But the absolutely incredible thing about Matt Davidson is, again, I'm going back to chase rate. It's not great radio, but it is what it is. Last year, Matt Davidson swung at a third of the pitches he saw out of the strike zone. A third of the pitches. That's not extreme. That's not Javier Baez territory, but that's high. That's higher than league average. He's cut that down by a third. He's now swinging at one out of every five pitches out of the strike zone. And that's just something we've more or less never seen, certainly not full season to full season. So it's an extreme amount of discipline. He's still swinging at strikes to the same amount that he did last year. It's just like overnight, Matt Davidson learned, oh, if you don't swing at the bad pitches, then you get more of the good pitches and you draw walks. It's not a coincidence. His walk rate has like tripled or quadrupled. He's striking out a lot less. Power has never been a problem. He's been extremely powerful all along. I think at 27 years old, you wonder how long his career is going to go. But we have a number of these sort of late bloomers, not just Justin Turner, but the Mariners have Mitch Haniger, who's broken out at 27 mm-hmm. years old. These people are around. So I think if you're the White Sox, you figure Davidson is here. He's really good now. And if he keeps this up over a full season, he's not only going to be really desirable in the offseason, but he's a guy that you bat fourth or fifth in the lineup. Takes a lot of pressure off Jose Abreu if he's still around. So, yeah, I think over the offseason, I thought Davidson was maybe the worst regular designated hitter in the American League. I thought the White Sox were going to work to replace him. I half expected them to end up with Matt Kemp of all people, and here we are. And Matt Davidson is looks like he's a really good hitter now, just all of a sudden. And I don't know. You were talking to him. What did he do? How did he learn his play discipline?
Well, he talked with Paul Konerko a lot in the offseason, actually, and it was a conversation that he really enjoyed, a lengthy one to be sure, but he was pretty impressed by the launch angle that had come down. I think in your piece, you wrote that the launch angle had come down, and Matt's not a real huge, you know, numbers dude, but he heard that, perked up a bunch, and what he said was, oh, that's more doubles, that's more base hits, that's more of what he needs, because he's always been able to get the walks or the strikeouts or the home runs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that when I've looked at his sort of swing path as much as you can from the outside, he is hitting the ball in the air less. But you know, there are the towering fly ball guys. You think when you hear about a guy who's hitting the ball in the air less, you think, oh, he's a ground ball machine. But take someone like Giancarlo Stanton, someone like Nelson Cruz. These are not guys who try to hit towering fly balls. Their home runs are line drives because they're trying to hit the ball back up the middle. Just a little above the horizontal, if you want to put it that way. And I think that Matt Davidson he has aimed lower, so he's hitting fewer fly balls and he's hitting more line drives, which for Matt Davidson, it probably does make him less exploitable in different areas of the strike zone.
We've had a theme that's been recurring when it comes to the Cubs in these meetings against the White Sox and playing against the Marlins, where some Cub fans are dismayed with the percentage of the runs that they score against the bottom feeders of baseball. And in the research that we did, just some shallowly done stuff, everybody does that. And good teams do that. Good teams beat bad teams. They run up numbers against bad teams. Good players pad their stats, for lack of a better term, against bad teams. But when do you find that it matters? When do you find that you get some predictive nature to this to say, look, when the playoffs start and they start going up against a team that's setting up its pitching staff, that's going to be using all high-leverage guys, that maybe these aren't going to be the same players in those matchups? When do we actually suss things out from playing against good and playing against bad?
Yeah, so it's not real easy to research this. There's a website called Baseball Reference. Everyone should be familiar with Baseball Reference, and they do split things out. You can look at how a team has done against teams who are better than 500 and teams who are worse than 500. That's about the extent of it, and I've looked at this before. I've looked for teams who have the greatest difference in one direction. I've looked for teams who had the greatest difference in the other direction, and it just hasn't been predictive that at all. You look at recent versions of the Washington Nationals, and now granted, they have struggled to make it out of their playoff rounds, but they've beaten up on bad teams in the NL East for years, for as long as they've been a good baseball team, and they've still been strong. I think you look at the Nationals, that's not a team that's just a byproduct of beating up on teams like the bad Phillies or the Marlins or the bad version of the Mets. I know every single team does do it. And then on the other hand, if you have your team that gets shut down by some unknown number five on a bad team, you think, oh, that's so Cubs or that's so White Sox, depending on what you're talking about. But that happens to everyone, too. Those are just the games that stick out in your memory because you think that should never happen. So I think the greatest concern is basically strikeouts. If you have a team that is strikeout prone, then it's going to be exacerbated when you get to the playoff time and everyone's throwing 95, everyone has sharp stuff, and you're not just going up there against the, I don't know, Brandon Finnegans and Sal Romanos, because they're not going to see the playoffs. You're going to be looking at power stuff. So if you have a really strikeout heavy lineup, that is the only kind of lineup that can really be exploited in playoff time. But otherwise, I wouldn't be too concerned. Every team is beating up on the bad teams, and if you're not, you're probably a bad team yourself.
Like the Dodgers, maybe, because everyone saw that coming.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeff.
Absolutely.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.